Good morning. Well, today we've been kind of working our way through this series of a beautiful mess, and we have a beautiful mess for today. We're talking about David and Goliath. And I thought the best way I could start into this would just be to tell you kind of the closest I felt to David conquering Goliath. I was 20 years old. I was working as a counselor at a junior high camp, and Morgan just got back from a junior high camp, and I exchanged a glance with Morgan this morning, and it told me everything I needed to know. It was like she just went to junior high camp for a week. Okay, we're there. Like everything there is to that. So great experience. No, I was 20 years old. I got asked to be like a volunteer cabin leader at a junior high camp. Never done anything with junior hires before. And I went to like the meeting where we get like introduced to the students, and I have like six students that I'm responsible for. And immediately after like introducing myself to these students, two of them go over to the youth pastor in charge and they ask to be transferred out of my cabin because I wasn't as cool as the other cabin leader, Chris. And to be honest, Chris is one of the coolest guys I know, so fair point. But immediately I kind of had this feeling of like, I do not belong here. We get up to this camp. It's at Black Lake up near Olympia, Washington. And all week long, there's these ridiculous games, ridiculous contests. They're divided. There's four teams representing different parts of the camp where different geographical regions where people had come from. And so our team, the Jacksonville, Oregon team, like, we're competing in these challenges all week to try to earn points. And one day, the challenge was similar to this American Gladiators exercise. There's a balance beam, and you're given kind of these implements where you're trying to knock your opponent off the balance beam. Now, if at this point you're wondering, what does this have to do with, like, showing people how to love in the way of Jesus? Fair question. Fair question. I don't have an answer for that. I just know that it was a lot of fun. And so they start into this this competition, and each team is supposed to kind of compete amongst themselves and figure out who their own champion is, and then they kind of put forward their champion in like kind of a final four, like, you know, death match or something. So first they have like all of the male students compete, and sure enough, a Jacksonville student representing our whole team, he goes and he wins the whole competition. So we get like 1,000 points and everybody's cheering and we're like, all right, you know, way to go, Evan. Like, so then we send out like our female student representative and she goes and she wins her competition and we're like, way to go, Heather. Like, we just won. So we've got like 2,000 points. This is great. So then they're like, all right, pick your best female leader and have her come out and represent your team. And so my friend Katie, who's like a college athlete, she's in like incredible shape, she gets chosen to represent our team. She goes and she knocks a couple people off and she's the champion. So the Jacksonville team has won 3 of the 4 events. We're just racking up the points. And so then it comes to male leaders. They're like, pick your best male leader. Well, it's me and my buddy Chris, and Chris looks at me and he's like, you're up. And I was like, oh man. So I'm like, all right, I step forward, and the 3 other challengers from these different teams are all, like, big dudes. Like, I'm a pretty good-sized guy. These are, like, big dudes. They're all significantly larger than me. And so we step forward, and we're in the middle of this grass field, and then the person who's kind of facilitating all of this, they say, all right, we're moving down to the dock. We're going to compete on the dock, which means you're trying to knock your opponent into the lake. And I kind of have this moment where I'm like, what have I gotten myself into? Like, and then I have one of the camp directors was my junior high football coach. I hadn't seen him in probably, you know, 7 or 8 years. And he comes up to me and he puts his arm around my shoulder and he says, keep your feet moving and just get lower than those guys. And I was like, all right. So I'm like, I'm going to go down to this dock and I'm going to win this event because my team is counting on me. So I walk down to the dock. Well, the other 3 guys, they all go back to the cabin and they change. They put on their swim trunks, tank tops, no shoes. I go down onto the dock and I'm wearing blue jeans, sweatshirt, tennis shoes. And I walk onto the dock and one of the guys goes, why aren't you wearing your swimsuit? And I said, because I'm not going in the water. And right then it was like I knew, like, psychological advantage achieved. Like, and sure enough, like, competition starts, it's this flurry of activity, and within like 30 seconds, there's these three huge guys like bobbing in the water, and I'm on the dock, and I was like, I have conquered, you know? And immediately what happens? Those two boys that wanted out of my cabin, they come up and they're like, that was so awesome! And I was like, yeah, I'm a lot cooler than you thought, right? Like, so I think back of that story, and I mentioned at the beginning, like, am I a little uncomfortable thinking about that? Like, what is that event doing in a junior high camp? Is that really the most constructive use of time? No, it's not. I'm uncomfortable thinking about it, and yet, as you can tell in my telling of the story, there's something about it that still kind of gets me going. Like, there's something about it that was still like, yeah, that was a pretty awesome moment, even though I think, like, on a moral level, I think I wonder even what its purpose is. Like, I say all of that just as an intro to the story of David and Goliath is kind of one of those stories to me that on some level it resonates deeply, and on some level I just want to get as far away from it as I can. This story is a complicated story. There's a big part of me that thinks we should just leave this story behind. It was a story that had great meaning to a group of people 3,000 years ago, but it's not really a story for our time and place. Just to give you a brief background, there are two armies. There is the Philistine army and the kingdom of Israel led by King Saul, the very fledgling kingdom of Israel. And they are preparing for war with one another, and they are on opposite edges of a valley. They're high on these ridges overlooking the valley of Elah. The Philistines are on the southern edge, and King Saul and the Israelites are on the northern edge. And so, from a tactical standpoint, if one army wants to achieve victory over the other army, they have to cross down across the valley and then fight their way uphill. And so that's assumed by both sides to be kind of a suicide mission. So they decide to settle it, as actually happened in ancient times more often than you might think. The Philistines decide to kind of make a sort of challenge to the Israelites, and they send their best warrior down into the valley to challenge the Israelites to come forth and fight him. And they actually make this same offer over and over again for 40 days in a row, sending this great warrior Goliath out into the valley where he invites the Israelites to send forth a challenger. Ancient armies, interestingly enough, actually did this as a way of reducing bloodshed. They actually thought about it and thought, why don't we just have two guys fight and one of them die, and that saves a lot of us a lot of heartache. I didn't know that before reading this story. Nevertheless, this is a fight to the death. This is kind of a barbaric ritual, is it not? It's a barbaric ritual from a primitive time. Haven't we evolved beyond this as a way of settling disputes? I would hope that we have. And yet, David and Goliath, I would wager, is the most popular story in the Bible. And when I say popular, I mean, I think if you were to take a survey of the average American, you would find that they can at least get some of the details of David and Goliath probably as readily as they could pull details of any story that we find in the Bible. And so I found myself, as much as I'm kind of disgusted by the barbaric nature of this, like, fight to the death as a way of achieving some sort of result in a conflict, there's part of me that thinks, what is it about this story that has kind of captured our imagination? I think there's two elements to that. I think one element is kind of the ultimate showdown, kind of the protagonist versus antagonist. You think about, I'm a big movie buff, so obviously I start thinking about all of the movies that I can think of, that kind of the climax is like good versus evil, good guy versus bad guy, protagonist versus antagonist, and they're gonna kind of fight to settle it all. You have like Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. You have, if you're more of a Lion King fan, it's Simba versus Scar. If you watched any superhero movie ever, you know that that's the climactic scene. If you've watched Rocky or The Karate Kid, like all of those movies end with this climactic kind of battle scene with the protagonist and the antagonist. And so I think there's something in that that resonates with us. And my suspicion is it's not so much like a desire to fight our enemies to the death, but I think it's the reality that we all have Goliaths lurking somewhere in our lives. We all have these challenges that are out there that seem insurmountable. And when we think about how overwhelming they are, we choke up a little bit with fear, or we lose sleep with anxiety, thinking about the ever-present nature of these conflicts. And these takes on different forms, I would guess, for each person in this room, but I think we all have something that represents Goliath. And so we draw hope from this story of the giant being overthrown. We draw some kind of hope that in our own struggle, that someday that unconquerable struggle will be finished and we'll be able to be victorious. I think there's that longing that lies deep within us. I also think we love a good underdog. I think we love underdog stories. In addition to being a movie buff, I'm a big sports fan, and I noticed that any time in sports you have a major upset or a major favorite playing an underdog of sorts, they reference David and Goliath. Most recently, it was the World Cup final earlier this month, where you had France, who's considered one of the most popular teams in the world. Every World Cup, they're considered one of the leading favorites to win the World Cup. And France, in the final game, was playing Croatia. Croatia as a nation had never made a World Cup final. Many of the players on the Croatian team had actually been birthed into the middle of a civil war. Some of them had even had to flee for their lives into other countries. This wasn't the type of environment that you thought would produce a world-class athletic team years later, and that yet here they were squaring off with France in the final game, and commentators frequently said this is kind of a David and Goliath matchup. So there was something of that kind of underdog versus the favorite matchup that resonates. To point out some of the ways in which David is kind of seen as an underdog, I just wanted to read some portions of the story. It's a pretty long story. I'm not going to try to read the whole thing, but I just kind of wanted to highlight where we get that underdog idea from. The first is in 1 Samuel chapter 17. That's where the whole story is. But the first section early on in that chapter, it says, a champion named Goliath from Gath came out from the Philistine camp. He was more than 9 feet tall. Might be a bit of an exaggeration. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore bronze scale armor weighing 125 pounds. He had bronze plates on his shin and a bronze javelin hung on his back. His spear shaft was as strong as the bar on a weaver's loom and its iron head weighed 15 pounds. His shield bearer walked in front of him. So Goliath clearly is described as an incredibly imposing figure. I don't know that he was actually 9 feet tall, but I think he was probably pretty large. Like, I thought maybe if we just think of Shaquille O'Neal, this is him standing next to the comedian Kevin Hart. And you can imagine, like, okay, so Shaquille O'Neal was, he's 7'1", 330 pounds. He has size 22 shoes. So if you saw somebody like that covered in a sheet of armor, you might go, that guy's like 9 feet tall. Like, he's a big guy. So Goliath is this imposing, menacing figure. It says, later on it says, he stopped and shouted to the Israelite troops, why have you come and taken up battle formations? I am the Philistine champion, and you are Saul's servants. Isn't that right? Select one of your men and let him come down against me. If he is able to fight me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I overcome him and kill him, then you will become our servants, and you will serve us. I insult Israel's troops today. As if that wasn't obvious by what he just said. Like, well, by the way, I'm disrespecting you when I say that. The Philistine continued, give me an opponent and we'll fight. It says, when Saul and all of Israel heard what the Philistine said, they were distressed and terrified. So Goliath issues this challenge and all of Israel is overwhelmed with fear. Meanwhile, a lowly shepherd boy, David, who was supposed to be tending his father's flocks while his older brothers were preparing to go to war, he shows up on the scene. And the way that the story is told, the only reason David was even on the front lines was because he was delivering rations of food to his brothers and their fellow soldiers. And he starts kind of asking around about who this Goliath guy is and what the reward is for dethroning Goliath. And so it says, when David's oldest brother Eliab heard him talking to the soldiers, he got very mad at David. And he said, why did you come down here? Who is watching those few sheep for you in the wilderness. I know how arrogant you are and your devious plan. You came down just to see the battle. So David, who's not even supposed to be on the front lines, he's dismissed by his older brother as just a runt. He's in the wrong place at the wrong time. He has no part in this battle. Meanwhile, David keeps asking around, and eventually he gets face to face with King Saul, and he kind of volunteers as tribute, so to speak. He says, I can do this. I can go fight Saul. And the king responds to him, you can't go out and fight this Philistine. You are still a boy, but he's been a warrior since he was a boy. So the king has no confidence in David to fulfill this mission. But eventually, David kind of wears the king down. And so the king decides, all right, we're going to let David do this. And so we're told that Saul dressed David in his own gear, putting a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David strapped his sword on over the armor, but he couldn't walk around well because he'd never tried it before. I can't walk in this, David told Saul. You can imagine this kid like wearing this adult man's armor. I've never tried it before. So he took them off, and he grabbed his staff and chose 5 smooth stones from the stream bed. He put them in the pocket of his shepherd's bag and with sling in hand went to the Philistine. So David isn't even wearing armor for this colossal showdown. So just kind of to summarize the points of why David is an underdog, Goliath is this incredibly imposing figure wearing 125 pounds of armor and somewhere around 9 feet tall. All of Israel is terrified of him. David is this lowly shepherd boy. He's not even supposed to be on the front lines. The king doesn't really believe that he can accomplish anything. And he's not even wearing the right equipment. All he's taking with him is a staff and a few stones. There's nothing in the telling of this story that gives you the impression that David will be triumphant. At least that was my impression of this story until a couple years ago I read a book by Malcolm Gladwell. He's my favorite author, and he wrote a book called David and Goliath: Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Now, Malcolm Gladwell is not a theologian. He's not a biblical scholar. He's a journalist for The New Yorker. He kind of writes about psychology and sociology. But he had this really kind of interesting fascination in this particular story. And so he spends the first chapter of his book, David and Goliath, doing this deep dive into ancient Mideast culture to try to learn about this David and Goliath story. And Gladwell comes to the conclusion that we're telling the story wrong. First, he argues, he says, David is mischaracterized as an underdog. David was not an underdog in this battle. David's strategy was actually very sound. Goliath was inviting his opponent into single combat method. That was assumed by Goliath to be a sort of a close contact fight. But there are 3 kinds of soldiers in ancient Mideast society. There were cavalry soldiers who rode on horseback. There were infantry soldiers like Goliath who carried swords and wore armor. And then there were the artillery, otherwise known as slingers. Slingers practiced slinging rocks at high speeds over long distances. Now, when I first heard the story of David and Goliath, I think I imagined like a kid with a slingshot, kind of like Dennis the Menace, like, and just kind of happens to like make the magic shot. That's not what was involved here. Slingers were a very specific type of highly trained soldier. The sling was a devastating weapon. Paintings from medieval times actually show people slinging birds out of the air. I was talking to, after the first service, Brad Kent came up to me and he said, I was down in Latin America and I saw small children slinging birds out of the air. And I was like, wow, that's incredible. Irish slingers were known, they could hit a coin if it was close enough for them to see it. That's how accurate they were with a sling. An experienced slinger was said to be able to kill or seriously injure a target at a distance of up to 200 yards. Right? So slingers were actually credited with turning the tide of the Peloponnesian War in ancient Greece because of the effect that they had on the opposing artillery. And David, we're led to believe, was an experienced slinger. When he's advocating for himself with King Saul, part of the appeal he makes is to his own experience, and he says, "Your servant has kept his father's sheep, and if ever a lion or a bear came and carried off one of the flock, I would go after it, strike it, and rescue the animal from its mouth. If it turned on me, I would grab it at its jaw, strike it, and kill it. Your servant has fought both lions and bears." Starting not to sound like a lowly shepherd boy anymore, is it? This is maybe a young man, but he has a fierceness to him. He doesn't really seem to be afraid of much. Something else that's telling is that when Goliath invites David to battle, he says, "Come here and I'll feed your flesh to the wild birds and the wild animals." So Goliath's assumption is that David will come to him. Can you imagine the surprise when Goliath realizes that David actually doesn't have a plan of coming to him at all? This is where Malcolm Gladwell says that if anybody is sitting on the ridge overlooking this battle as it takes place, once David stops and takes out his sling and puts a rock in the swing and starts swinging it, it's game over. They would realize that Goliath had dressed for a battle that David had no business being in. And so David changed the rules of the game and entered for a different sort of contest. And all of a sudden the scales have tipped dramatically and David is no longer the underdog. David is the heavy favorite because he's bringing something else to the conflict. Gladwell also argues that we mischaracterize Goliath as the unbeatable favorite. Yes, he's covered with all of this imposing armor, but Goliath does not act like a mighty warrior. He's accompanied by a shield bearer, which was unconventional for a mighty warrior. Shield bearers generally went with archers because archers couldn't hold a shield. So the fact that Goliath has a third party assisting him seemed to imply that there was some lack of steadiness on his part. At another time, Goliath is described as being slow of foot. And then he has this curious interaction with David where he looks at David across the field and he says, "Am I some sort of dog that you should come to me with sticks?" And he uses that word sticks, and it's pluralized in the Hebrew form, which is interesting because David seemed to only be carrying one staff. This is where it gets interesting. What many medical experts now believe is that, in fact, Goliath had a serious medical condition. He looks and sounds like someone suffering from what is called acromegaly. I had to practice that pronunciation. It's not a term I was familiar with, but acromegaly is a disease caused by a benign tumor of the pituitary gland. And the tumor causes an overproduction of human growth hormone, which would explain Goliath's extraordinary size. The tallest person in recorded history, Robert Wadlow, suffered from this disease. And he was 8 feet 11 inches and apparently still growing at the time of his death. So maybe that 9-foot estimation might not have been so far off. One of the side effects of acromegaly, anybody guess? Vision problems, oftentimes resulting in double vision. So one wonders, when Goliath is looking across the field and he says, "Am I some sort of dog that you come at me with sticks?" Is he seeing two sticks, or is he simply unable to track who's in front of him? Gladwell summarizes it. He says, "What the Israelites saw from high on the ridge was an intimidating giant. In reality, the very thing that gave the giant his size was also the source of his greatest weakness." What if this story is not the story of an underdog who slayed a giant with a lucky blow? What if this story is a group of people facing an overwhelming conflict, a conflict that filled them with fear and despair and lack of faith, and an individual drawing on his own experience to think outside the box and engage with that conflict in a creative way? What if this story is about seemingly insurmountable obstacles that just need to be looked at in a different way and lose their power? You know, I mentioned at the beginning, Goliath comes in many forms. I don't think the lesson for this is to go out and challenge our enemies into a fight to the death. I do think we've moved past that. But I think we can carry this story forward in other ways. I think we carry this story forward when we choose, like David, to not be afraid or to even keep going despite our fear. Do you know that's the most common command in the entire Old Testament? Do not be afraid. I think it appears something like over 100 times. Do not be afraid, do not be afraid. And I think that's in there because fear compromises our convictions. When we react out of fear, we treat people as objects. When we react out of fear, we value scarcity over generosity. When we react out of fear, we value judgment instead of grace. What if we were people of hope instead? What if we engaged the Goliaths of our world as people of hope? I want to tell you one story to close. It's kind of my favorite story from history, I think, of a David and Goliath moment coming to life. It took place in East Germany in the 1980s. There was a pastor named Christian Führer at St. Nicholas Church in Leipzig in East Germany. Now, if you know history of that time, East Germany in the 1980s, it was a very oppressive dictatorship that was ruling that country, and they ruled through fear and through depriving people of basic freedoms. Well, in 1982, Pastor Führer started a Monday evening prayer group. Now, such a prayer group would actually be kind of not allowed by the government of the time, but so few people came to Pastor Führer's prayer group that the government didn't seem to notice. So about a dozen people were gathering on a weekly basis, and they were praying together for peace. After 3 years of doing this in small groups, Pastor Führer made a small change. He put a sign out on the wall of the church, out on the door, and it said, "Open to all." Monday evening prayer group. And people in East Germany seemed to realize that that phrase maybe had some more symbolism to it, that maybe this was a place where conversations could happen that couldn't happen out on the streets. And so this prayer group began to grow. Young people started showing up to it. People who wouldn't even describe themselves of faith, people who would describe themselves as atheists, started coming to these prayer groups because they found that there was some sort of life happening there that wasn't happening anywhere else. Other churches in East Germany began following suit and having similar prayer gatherings. In May of 1989, this prayer group had grown to such a force that the East German government decided to barricade the streets leading to the church, yet somehow attendance grew. Beatings and arrests happened in Leipzig, in Berlin, in Dresden, throughout East Germany. Those attending these prayer meetings were beaten and arrested by the police, and yet still these meetings grew. In October of 1989, there were hundreds of arrests in front of St. Nicholas Church. Erich Honecker, the communist leader of East Germany at the time, he declared that the church should be closed. And they ran a newspaper advertisement in the local paper, and they said this prayer meeting will be stopped by whatever means necessary. So on the following Monday, October 9th, 8,000 people showed up to St. Nicholas Church. Here's a picture of the gathering. There were so many people that other churches in the neighborhood opened their doors to accommodate additional people. And at St. Nicholas Church, Pastor Führer, he led the worshipers in an hour-long service. And then they walked outside, they lit candles, and they marched through the city. And they chanted, "We are the people, no violence. We are the people, no violence." And as they were approaching the headquarters of the Stasi, the secret police in East Germany, tension kind of mounted because those in the march knew that if this was going to come to catastrophe, it was going to be right there. And yet the police simply backed away and let the marchers pass by. One East German official would later say they were ready for anything that day except candles and prayer. The following Monday, 120,000 protesters took to the streets. A week later, 300,000. On November 9th, 1 month after the newspaper advertisement said it would be stopped by whatever means necessary. 1 month later, the Berlin Wall came down. I remember traveling in Germany when I was a college student, and I met a former German pastor from East Germany, and he told us the story about how prayer brought down the Berlin Wall. And just this morning after the 8:30 service, I encountered a man from Germany, and I didn't tell the story because I didn't have enough time at the shorter service, but I encountered a man from Germany and introduced myself, and I said, oh, later this morning I'm telling a story about what happened in East Germany to bring down the Berlin Wall, and he just smiles and nods and says, candles and prayer. When I think about this story, I think about this group in its early stages, a dozen people meeting in this church under the secrecy of fear and oppression. I don't think that community of people was leaving the story of David and Goliath behind. I think they were carrying it forward in a new way. And in the same way, we carry this story forward anytime we choose hope in the face of fear, anytime we engage with conflict in a creative way, anytime we trust God to give us the strength to conquer the unconquerable, we're taking this story from 3,000 years ago and we're putting a new spin on it and we're carrying it forward, not as a means simply of defeating our enemies, but even as a way of extending love to our enemies. Nelson Mandela said, may your choices reflect your hopes, not your fears. Amen. We continue in worship with our offering.